So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F-35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. You've been watching the headlines. There have been more than 19,000 confirmed cases of flu in Wisconsin. But there's another malady that you've also heard a lot about. That's the coronavirus. And the numbers worldwide, 77,150 confirmed cases, 2,592 deaths worldwide, none in Wisconsin. So I think it's a great time to get a perspective from two of our Department of Health Services medical professionals. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Tom Haupt is Respiratory Disease Epidemiologist, with the Department of Health Services. Gentlemen, thanks very much for coming in here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Let's begin. Should Wisconsinites at this point, given all the news, should we be more concerned about the flu than the coronavirus? Let's do a 10,000-foot question first.
Okay, I'll start off with that one. I really think that with the way flu has increased over the past few weeks in its intensity statewide, especially hitting the younger populations, people need to be very much aware of that. Unfortunately, we have had three pediatric deaths reported this year and over 40 cases of people who have died from complications of the flu. We're really continuing to push influenza vaccine. We're at a record. We got 41% of the residents in Wisconsin are vaccinated.
That's a record?
That's a record. And it's not a very high record, but we can do better. But you have to look at the opposite of that as well. That means that almost 60% have not been vaccinated for influenza, and it's not too late.
Dr. Ryan, why do almost 60% not get vaccinated?
Well, one thing that's unique about the influenza vaccine is that you need to get it every single year.
Yep.
So tetanus shots every 10 years. There are certain childhood vaccines where they sort of cover you for the most of your life. The influenza vaccine is something that, you know, in the fall, the virus changes every year, so a new vaccine. So I think it's that sustained attention that needs to be paid for that, which makes it hard to implement on a year-by-year basis. I think when the public awareness of influenza, I think, waxes and wanes as well. Yeah. Right now, it's definitely in the public's attention because there's a lot of cases. This year particularly has been bad, and we have this other respiratory virus causing headlines. So it's a good time to spread the word and, you know, sound the alarm that influenza vaccine is effective and it's still recommended, it's available, and get the word out that people can still come in and get it.
Well, thanks to your agency for providing us the latest numbers on flu in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. This season, though, we're up to 19,496 as of last week, which is a 13% increase over last season. Mm-hmm. Why that fairly dramatic increase? Is it a different strain?
It is a different strain this year. The two strains that are circulating, the influenza B and the influenza H1, are both viruses that affect the younger population much more so than the elderly population. If we look at last year's statistics, over two-thirds of our hospitalizations were people over 65 years old, compared to this year where about one-third is over 65 years old.
That's a significant drop. Two-thirds to one-third?
Yes. But what we're seeing is a higher increase in the 18 to 49-year-olds. And the younger population are really getting hit hard. Younger children are getting hit very hard. And as I said, unfortunately, we have had three pediatric deaths reported to us.
Right, but I'm not saying it's a great thing, but the number of flu-related deaths are only about one-third this season. One-third less than last season.
Yes.
Thoughts on why?
Well, I think that makes sense when you look at the age group of who's the most highly affected in terms of infection. Mm-hmm. You know, influenza can be a lethal virus, but how lethal it is really depends on the patient. It depends on the comorbidities. So someone who is older, who has underlying lung disease or a weak immune system for whatever reason, is more likely to become gravely ill and to die for influenza. In years due to whatever reason or reasons we don't understand, the virus seems to affect younger, more healthy, it makes sense that the mortality rate or the death rate will be lower.
I find it interesting. The vaccination rate for flu varies widely by age. Mm-hmm. What's the age group that is least likely to get vaccinated?
Right now it's the 18 to 49-year-olds. Our highest are in our younger children, less than a year old, who are able to be vaccinated, up to 5 years old. And the over 65 population are by far the highest. But we've always had that lag with the 18 to 49-year-old population and really don't have an explanation why that is. A lot of those are parents, younger parents. We would think that that would be a high priority to protect their children. But for some reason, it's been historical that that age group is the lowest in the vaccine rates.
I always find it fascinating that every year, I think the CDC bets on what type of flu is going to present in a season. Mm-hmm. How did they do this season in terms of what's the prevention rate compared to other years?
Well, the vaccine efficacy was just came out last week, and it was actually not bad. It was 45% overall, 55% for young children and for people who had influenza B, meaning it's a 55% less chance of seeking medical attention. That's how those numbers should be interpreted.
Yes.
Those numbers are significantly higher than last year when we were down around 20 or even in the teens. So the changes that were made to the influenza vaccine really were effective. We obviously would love to see better vaccine efficacy. Maybe we will when the final numbers come out in June, but we're actually pleased with the numbers that came out. It corresponds with a good match.
Now, I know you're doing you're doing periodic updates at DHS, and the refrain is, it's still not too late to get a flu shot.
Absolutely.
Because the flu season is going to run through when?
We're going to continue to have cases into May. That's without a doubt. And I mentioned to some other people that it's not uncommon to have flu even during the summer. We went two straight years with at least one flu case, PCR-confirmed case of influenza amongst a resident. But the peak activity, we're close to peak activity right now, but we're going to be at very high activity for at least another 3 or 4 weeks or more.
3 or 4 weeks or more.
Yes.
Okay. Any PSs on flu before we turn the corner to coronavirus?
Not too late to get the vaccine. Please consider it for yourself and to protect those people who are around you.
Okay. Now let's talk about coronavirus. When did the agency get alerted that something was happening in China, in that region, and... I forget the province.
Hubei province. Yes,
Hubei province.
I think we were at this. I remember the day. I think we were at the same meeting where it was. Mm-hmm. It was sort of circulated in some of the kind of breaking news in global health, where there were about 60 cases localized in an area around an animal market in that province.
Yes.
And at that time, some investigation had been done. This was late November, early December, when the initial cases were done. And it was really unclear whether this was going to be something that was a person-to-person spread of a respiratory virus or something that just came from animals to humans. It really took a couple weeks to really shed light on the fact that this is a respiratory virus that is at risk for person-to-person transmission. Throughout the month of December and then January, we sort of have been watching on a daily basis with a number of cases have spread out of the province of the Hubei province in China.
Yes.
And out to neighboring China. And now, of course, it's in 35 countries around the world, including North America. So it's something we've been watching very closely and with a fair amount of uncertainty with the degree to which it's going to spread outside of that area of Asia. But we're certainly very actively preparing for the possibility that we'll get more cases in this country and in Wisconsin.
Do you think it started out from animal to human?
I think it did. When they have these types of coronavirus, when they had the SARS virus back in 2003, I can't remember exact date. I think it was 2003. Mm-hmm. The MERS-CoV all was associated with animal exposures who were carrying it and spread that to humans. And we're seeing more and more of this zoonotic spread of diseases from animals. Zoonotic meaning that the animals have it and they give it to the human beings.
Okay.
Correct. So we're seeing more and more of that throughout the world. So we always have to be careful of the animals that we deal with, whether it's bats, whether it was civet cats, whatever the case may be, we have to be very careful and realize that what they have can be spread to human beings.
How did China react differently than other contagions? They locked up 76 million people or something. And is the goal there just to prevent them from moving, to stop the spread of the mm-hmm. disease? Is that a typical response?
Sure. I think that what the measures that they implemented in China and the regions are variations on a theme of what we do anytime there's a communicable disease epidemic, which is try to understand what factors put people at risk of person-to-person transmission, and then try to separate people. The tonic, if you will, of responding to a respiratory virus is actually social distancing. So we need to get people who are have the virus, who are infected, who have the virus contained in their respiratory droplets, far away enough from people that they're not going to transmit it by coughing or speaking with somebody. So that's really the fundamental activity. Now, how you do that on a societal level when there's thousands of people expected uses different kinds of tools than we do in a healthcare system when it's when it's one person in a room. So restricting people's travels and canceling public events are tools that can be used for that purpose of trying to decrease the spread of the disease. And I think any government, whether it's a national government in this country or others, has to make those calls. What's the best way to protect susceptible people from becoming exposed to the virus? So I think that principle has really underlined all the things that were done in China and neighboring countries.
There's a term that I read getting ready for this show, tracing. So if someone is confirmed, then health officials have to trace everybody they've been in contact with?
People with close contact. It's very difficult to do.
What we're looking at are
people who have extended period of time, and that is not really defined. But within 6 feet. So, well, like us at the table here, we would be potentially exposed if one of us came down with the coronavirus. So we would be monitoring the other two people who were exposed but not ill, making sure that they perhaps are isolated depending on what their risk factors are. So it's a very complicated system. It starts off with a very thorough interview of the patient and really looking for as much honesty as that person can provide and following up from a public health point of view.
Well, what about these guns that point at your head and tell whether you have a temperature? Do you health professionals trust those?
I don't know a lot of data about those, to be honest with you. I wish I could give you a much better answer to it than that. I prefer the old under-the-tongue method for taking a temperature, or in the ear, something like that. But I really don't know how accurate those temporal ones are. So,
what about these things? I mean, are we at the point where Wisconsin residents... I'm not trying to scare people, and you aren't either.
Yeah.
But now it's spread to Iran, Italy, and South Korea. And 77,150 as of today confirmed cases, 2,592 deaths. You're not saying that we in Wisconsin have to go around with this or this.
Yeah.
Are you health professionals?
The question about masks is a good one.
Do these work?
Well, they work, but I think it's helpful to talk about what are they useful for. So they're very useful in healthcare settings,
yes,
when there's a person who has a communicable disease, to try to prevent transmission of respiratory droplets to another person. And so the way that transmission happens is usually close contact. So in healthcare settings, very routine, where if I'm examining as a physician or a provider, I'm examining a patient where either I might have a sore throat or a cold, or the patient has a respiratory virus, you know, we wear gowns to prevent that transmission of virus. But it's really helpful within, like Tom said, close contact or 6 feet. So outside of healthcare settings, you can sort of extrapolate to how those might or might not be useful. There's really no evidence that in the general public, walking around on the bus, for example, or walking down the sidewalk, that it would do very good. And that's not recommended by the CDC or anyone in terms of public health authorities. You know, if in a household setting where a family member is taking care of another family member and they want to decrease the chance that someone that they get exposed to a respiratory virus, they may play a role. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful just to think about what are these tools useful for? And I think, as Tom mentioned, there's not a blanket recommendation that masks are useful out in the community. But when you think about them as a tool to promote what you might call respiratory hygiene, mm-hmm, to prevent the spread of potentially infectious respiratory droplets, that's really where they're useful. And so they're a core measure of what we do in clinics and hospitals to prevent transmission. They might be useful in the home in some things, but not in the general community, not out in the
world. Tom, should every home have one of these?
Well, again, it's not a recommendation at this particular point. And I have to mention, too, that these things are attention grabbers when you wear them out in the public.
Yes.
People see them, and then they get frightened that maybe this person has something like the coronavirus or flu, when in fact they don't have anything wrong with
them.
And
other people wear them because they want to prevent and
right,
not come in contact.
They want to prevent, right. They are definitely attention grabbers.
And so you don't know anybody's motives.
Yes.
Whether I might be coming down with something, so I'm wearing it, or I don't want to come down with anything.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not yet at the point where people...
Not yet.
Yeah. I think a message is that, you know, we don't recommend that they're used widespread. If anyone chooses to, don't judge them for don't make any assumptions on the on their motives. People should feel comfortable doing it if they need to, but mm-hmm. but our public health recommendation is not that the general public needs to be wearing masks in public.
There have been incidents elsewhere, not in Wisconsin. Let's say it again, not in Wisconsin, where some people wearing masks have been we don't want to they've been rejected mm-hmm. by society and others around them. Yes. Now, you're not aware of any incidents in Wisconsin, right?
I have not heard of any, but I have heard them anecdotally, nationally, just like, yes.
Right. Doctor, which is more effective?
Of those two that yeah. you have? I think they both, you know, they're both serve the purpose of keeping respiratory droplets. There are higher levels of masks, so the so-called N95, which have been designed for highly infectious pathogens like tuberculosis that can stay spread. Those we use in hospital settings as well. For most settings, outpatient clinics, the regular surgical masks seem to be doing just fine.
Okay, I'll put aside my props. Let's look at the actual numbers for the coronavirus in Wisconsin. Let's go to that graphic. COVID-19 in Wisconsin, number of tests for COVID-19, 17. Number of positive tests, 1. Number of COVID-related deaths in Wisconsin, 0, which we're all glad for. The U.S. number I just checked, U.S. confirmed cases, I believe 53. Does that sound right?
Yes, I believe that is correct.
Yeah. That's confirmed cases. That's not deaths.
That's not deaths.
Right. Has the United States had any confirmed deaths, to best of your knowledge?
As of earlier today, the answer
no.
is no.
No, the only death from an American citizen happened in China, but there was no deaths in the United States for any U.S. citizens.
Okay. 17 tests, 1 positive. Are you optimistic about this number? Or check with me tomorrow, check with me next week, check with me next month? How are you guys playing this day by day? Yeah, at DHS?
I think we're cautiously optimistic that yes. at this moment there's not reason to think that this virus is spreading mm-hmm. in Wisconsin mm-hmm. and that we are not at risk of having much larger numbers. You know, I say cautiously optimistic because what we don't know is the degree to which in other countries and mm-hmm. in other states. Community-based transmission will start to occur.
Yes.
So a week from now, we might be in a very different place. But right now, I think we're all on the same page in public health to say that mm-hmm. the risk to the general population for this virus at this time is very low.
Less than 5% positive nationwide versus flu, which is about 40% at this particular point. So flu is definitely your main issue dealing with it. And again, I don't want to keep reiterating, but it's not too late to get the vaccine and protect yourselves.
I tried to find the mortality rate for coronavirus, and I was told it's just too imprecise. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Correct.
I mean, somebody else suggested 2%. Is there any number you're comfortable with?
Well, I think if you had the 2% number comes from mm-hmm. a research study looking at the early experience that I think was well conducted based mm-hmm. on the available evidence. But of course, it's really limited by the fact that asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic cases, meaning people who might have infection but not present to healthcare services to get tested and get counted, don't go into that equation. So it's probably a large overestimate where the number of people who may have similar to influenza who develop an infection but don't feel ill enough to go seek medical attention. So using the data of saying of the people who have been confirmed to have it, the number who have severe cases and deaths, those data are reliable based on who they measured. But the caveat is that we're not measuring potentially a lot of people mm-hmm. with mild or no symptoms. So the estimate of 2% has been published. It's out there. I think many people believe that the true risk to anyone who becomes infected is probably quite a bit lower than that.
Well, what was the mortality rate with SARS and MERS? Was it much higher?
SARS and MERS, they were higher at the time from what I recall. I think SARS was up to 9%. I don't recall what MERS was at this particular point. That's the Middle East respiratory syndrome. But I think they were higher than what we are seeing with this COVID-19.
Is there one age demographic that is more likely to succumb to coronavirus?
Yes. What we're seeing in China is that many of the people who are severely ill and who have died are older. And I'm just going to use age over 65.
Thank you.
Slightly older, yes.
Okay.
I'm very close to that age, too. So, but that's pretty typical with many of the viruses, including influenza and including seasonal coronaviruses that are around all the time. So it's it definitely is going to hit the population who has a lower immune system, older population, younger population, but we have not seen much in children, especially in the United States.
Have not seen much in children. I have heard so much interesting and speculation, so much interest in speculation on how long it might take to get a vaccine for the coronavirus. Why? Because this is a new type virus that presents so differently? Or why are we talking? Are we talking months or years?
Yeah, I think we're talking years. And I think to put it into
plural.
To put it into context, the leadership of NIH has said optimistically would be that, you know, 18 months from now we might have studies showing a effective vaccine is available. That's extraordinarily fast. As far as general vaccine development goes, the ability to identify a target for a vaccine or the protein on the virus or bacteria itself that can even be leveraged in a way to create a vaccine sometimes takes decades. And of course, there are some viruses that we've been working very hard on for vaccines for years and have no promise. So HIV, for example, there's been billions of dollars spent at HIV vaccine research, and we still don't have one. So the idea that we could have a vaccine for coronavirus after just having discovered it in nature less than 6 months ago is extraordinarily exciting. It doesn't help us. You know, we'd like to have one now, of course. But you know, I think this is really medical science sort of at its most advanced in human history right now, to be able to identify a virus, get the genetic code, and translate that into a vaccine within less than 2 years would be a huge triumph. You know, so that's the context. It doesn't mean that a vaccine is not going to help us stem the tide of this epidemic right now in 2020. Right. We're going to have to do all the other things that we've been doing, which involves the standard public health measures like isolating people and getting people tested and respiratory hygiene and all the things that we're talking about.
I should have asked this earlier. The one person who tested positive in Wisconsin, has she been cleared? Is she still being quarantined? Is she free of the virus? Do you know?
I think the latest information is that that patient was doing well and cooperating with public health and sort of going through the standard recommendations. I don't think we have other specific information about that case, but there haven't been any secondary cases related to that one. So it's fortunate that everything went well.
Is there something in the characteristics of the coronavirus that most concerns you as health professionals?
I think it's too early to say that at this particular point, because they're continuing to do the molecular sequencing to really tear it apart and find out what's different about this virus than the other virus, coronaviruses. So for my purposes, I'm just following what I hear from the World Health Organization, from CDC, trying to put that all together and do my job, which is try to help the prevention and spread of it. But it's, again, a very new virus that we're dealing with, and there's going to be a lot of additional information coming in the not-too-distant future.
Well, what's the best hope for defeating the coronavirus? Is it a virus years out, or is it just people doing preventive measures? What's the good news?
I think the best tools we have now are the time-tested public health messages of respiratory hygiene, hand washing, staying home when you're sick, those things that we do every respiratory virus season. The other things on a slightly larger scale is, as we learn things specifically about this epidemic, is just to have good communication at all levels of government and putting into plan. You know, if things spread more rapidly, if we get into sort of some of the activities that are related to sort of pandemic preparedness, which we've been talking about for flu for years, you know, doing those in ways that are responsible and effective and equitable and communicating in a timely way with healthcare providers and the public.
How is someone who is confirmed with coronavirus, how is she or he treated?
Well,
what's the protocol?
Sure.
Or the modality?
So right now there's no specific treatment to make the virus, you know, to make the illness resolve more quickly. So there aren't antiviral drugs, similar to, like, we do have medicines for influenza, for some subtypes of influenza that are effective. So right now there's no treatment. So the management of people with coronavirus infection is really supportive care, which in most cases, fortunately, just involves time and symptom management, and the body will take care of it. It'll help resolve the infection by itself. And for people who have more severe disease, who need support with things like extra oxygen or blood pressure support or other secondary infections, those kind of interventions that are given in hospitals and intensive care units. So it's really not specific. It's really generally supportive care and letting the body recover itself, and doing so in a way that really protects the spread of healthcare providers and other patients in a really rigorous way. And hospitals in Wisconsin have very robust plans for infection control to do all of those things. So those are the good news. And fortunately, most people described so far, I've had relatively mild cases.
How does DHS respond if, and I hope this doesn't happen, and we all hope it doesn't happen, if it does turn into a pandemic? What does the agency, what do healthcare professionals do differently?
Well, it becomes more of a surge capacity where we have to have more laboratory testing done, more messaging out to the public. We will bring in people from different agencies to help us work with that and to work with the public. And communication, Steve, is probably one of the biggest things, to get that information out, to know so people have a reliable source of information as to what to do. We saw that during the pandemic. There was a lot of rumors going around. A lot of them were false, and maybe they were fun reading on the internet. But we're trying to get the message out that it's what's accurate, what people need to do, not to overreact, but not underreact either, and just take it very seriously. But we bring in a whole team of people who are going to be working with us, both from the laboratory and from public health.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Just a couple more questions. What does the coronavirus mean for one, Wisconsin lifestyles? Any changes suggested here?
So I would say no, not compared to our typical respiratory virus season.
That's a very welcome answer.
Yes. Good.
What about their health care decisions? Should they do anything differently if they
Symptoms? Yeah, so one of our early messages, which still applies when the test for this novel coronavirus is coming online, was that because it was novel, people who we weren't doing testing for this virus except in a narrow range of people who had a specific exposure of travel to the area of China. So that was a key message we wanted to get out to the public, was that if you have a respiratory illness, you have fever and sore throat and cough, troubled breathing, and you were to China, to call ahead and say, I saw the message about coronavirus, I have been to China, and I have these symptoms. Call your doctor ahead of time to let them know so they can be prepared to put you in a private room and so on and so forth. Short of that, though, we want people to use healthcare responsibly like they always do.
Mm-hmm. What about business travel? Planned business travel, of course, to Asia? China? Is that...
Right now it's not recommended.
Not recommended.
At this particular point. I believe they have a level 3 travel alert going on over there.
Thank you.
Several of the other countries, Iran, Italy, have level 1s. Level 1 meaning think about it before you go. Level 3 meaning don't go unless you absolutely have to. But it's not recommended to travel at that particular time to those particular areas.
Those things are changed sort of day-to-day basis, and the U.S. State Department website is the best source for up-to-date information about where the travel advisories are.
And if someone has booked a cruise, an international cruise, what's your advice for them? Because that some of the horror stories coming off that one ship, that it might have been spread through the ventilation system, and I said might because I'm not a scientist, but if someone has booked a cruise in the next 6 months internationally...
And then this question has come up, Steve, several times. I've taken calls from citizens saying, should I go on the cruise? I've already paid for it. I've got my deposit in. The cruise line will not give me my deposit back. All I can tell them is if you go that you have to practice good hygiene, and you also expect that from the other passengers. It is something that can spread very quickly, whether it's a diarrheal illness, respiratory illness can spread very, very quickly. They have to make the final decision on that, and I feel very sorry for them because I think a lot of people would like to cancel their cruise, but when they put thousands of dollars down on a deposit and it's something they booked 3-4 years ago, it makes for a very difficult situation. You have to feel for them.
Okay, almost out of time. Final question. What should Wisconsin residents know about the coronavirus now as you are watching it? Mm-hmm. Just very simply, what should they know, Doctor?
I would say that right now the risk is low to the general community, and it's not too late to get your flu shot.
Yes. Tom?
Take it seriously, but don't panic. Again, it's a low-risk virus at this particular point, but as Dr. Westergaard said, flu is around and it's spreading, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Okay. If part of the goal here is communication, anytime you want to come back to Wisconsin Eye to update Wisconsin mm-hmm. residents, you're more than welcome.
Okay? Much appreciated.
I want to thank Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, Tom Haupt, Respiratory Disease Epidemiologist, also for the Department of Health Services. Gentlemen, don't hesitate to come back if we need to do more to educate.
We would enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civic broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.